2001 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium, Why I Can't Write My Joseph Smith Play. Participants Gary Stewart and Tim Slubber.
This is session 361 of the 2001 Sunstone Symposium. And the title of the paper is Why I Can't Write My Joseph Smith Play. Our presenter is Gary Stewart. Now, I was a student at BYU at the same time as Gary and his late wife, Diana. And so when I saw his name in the program, I called up and I said, I want to chair that session because this is an old friend. So I'm excited to be able to introduce Gary Stewart to you. Now, I have this big, long bio here. I'm not going to read it all. But, you know, it's been almost 40 years since the last time I saw Gary. And I have to admit, I'm really impressed. He was one of our finer actors in the theater department at BYU when I was there. And he was in a lot of productions. And now it seems he's turned to writing and has written quite a few plays. Daddy's Gone Home, The Whitehead Family Reunion, The Terre Haute Cigar Store, Pecans and Proposals, Downwinder Dance, Mary and Joe, and The Joseph Smith Project. He's also written a couple of novels, and he is currently teaching. Where are you teaching now, Gary?
Indiana State University.
Okay. There's quite a few. He's taught a number of places, but Indiana State University is where he, and I think, is this Tim that has just walked in? Okay, good. Unfortunately, Tim has come in too late for me to get biographical information on him, so he will have to introduce himself to you when it's his turn to respond. But we're very happy to have Gary here, and I hope you will give him your welcome, and let's hear his paper on why he couldn't write his Joseph Smith play. Gary.
How should I do this? I hold that. Flip it on my lapel. Okay, I need to flip it. There it is. There we are. Can you hear me all right? One of my old graduate school friends did a paper this morning on possible theological justifications for same-sex unions. He looked at me in the back and wondered if I was a spy from the Boy Scouts. He said with his shirt, I got this shirt for $10 somewhere, so it was a bargain, not that I believe whatever this is. In April of this year, I directed, I think everybody can see me, I can see. In April of this year, I directed 10 of my students in an hour and 15-minute workshop production of the rough beginnings of a play I'd written. I'd been immersed in research and writing for 8 months, planning for over 20 years, strong on my mind for half a century. I called it the Joseph Smith Project. I wasn't happy with it, not at all. My good Mormon friends were troubled. Why didn't you emphasize the spiritual side of the prophet? My academic friends wondered if I'd lost all perspective. You still take this backwoods conjurer seriously? A couple of hardcore Southern Baptist students who were delighted by it suggested to them that Joseph Smith might indeed be the Antichrist. My theater colleagues declared the play fragmented and uneven, just a big mess, and they were right. Now, usually with my writing, I've at least pleased myself, maybe a few loved ones, sometimes even an audience of other people. But with this Joseph Smith thing, I just almost totally failed. I sure didn't please myself or my loved ones, and audiences were bewildered or upset or just bored. So why couldn't I get a bead on this guy, this prophet who'd haunted my dreams since I remember dreams? But I knew if I kept trying, I'd drive myself nuts. So I pondered what went wrong, and I began to figure a couple things out. First of all, you can't write a successful play unless you have a pretty clear idea who your audience is. They certainly aren't going to produce it in the new conference center. I'm not about to play to people who see demons when Joseph Smith's image pops up. There's my good and faithful and indulgent Indiana audience who have supported me through all my theatrical wanderings about in my Mormonism. But even they didn't get it, and they've suffered enough. Finally, there are those college kids I've taught for decades, but many seriously given themselves to Buddha or Jesus, and most appeared not to give much of a damn about religion of any kind. And those really smart off-Broadway patrons for whom I'd maybe like to write, Wallace Shawn's audience, Neil LaBute's audience, I just don't have enough of a grasp on a theme that would interest them. So I had to hope that as I wrote, my audience would come into view. I'd just focus on the primary task a playwright has before him, to create coherent, believable, and compelling characters. I've had good experiences over the years with just letting characters talk to me, have dialogue with me, write down their words. I'd try that. I just let Joseph talk to me. Except Joseph has been talking to me all my life, and I've heard his voice so long, I'm not really sure whether it's his voice or my voice. It's kind of like talking to myself. So maybe if I started with other characters in the play, with Martin and Oliver, with Emma and Lucy Mack, and Joseph Sr. But I had problems with them too. They'd always been these whispering attendants to my lifelong dialogues with Joseph. So I had to remind myself of something. I had to remind myself that I see the world differently than I did 40 years ago. I'd come on this long and sometimes tortured journey. Until I was 30, I pretty much defined my world and my understanding of Joseph Smith from an Orthodox perspective. I trusted what others said about him. I trusted the matrix in which they were saying what they said. When I got into theater, which was kind of this accident, I figured I'd keep thinking about my life and my religion and Joseph Smith from that same perspective. My theater would be just this highly attractive way to make a living. I'd teach and direct these good and proper plays I kind of like, maybe even at BYU. Plays like All My Sons, Arsenic and Old Lace, The Lady's Not for Burning, Romeo and Juliet, pretty good plays. But something happened. I started developing this other way of seeing the world, this other matrix. While I was teaching and doing, reading and directing plays, began to have an effect on me. I was developing what I came to call a theatrical way of seeing the world. I started getting more interested in the is's than the oughts, to being more interested in what people do and why people do what they do than what they ought to do. And I started being attracted to these really complex and puzzling and often decadent plays. Jacobean plays like The Changeling and 'Tis Pity She's a Whore. Plays like Blitzek and Uncle Vanya and Long Day's Journey into Night. Playwrights like Sam Shepard and Carol Churchill and Samuel Beckett. And for a great many years, my psyche was this kind of boiling cauldron. I got fascinated by the strange and anomalous choices people make, choices that are never quite clear no matter how you view them, bizarre choices, choices that often lead to despair and self-annihilation. And this started leaking into my ideas about Joseph Smith. I wanted to know everything that made him both this extraordinary prophet and at the same time this flawed and fascinating and opaque human being who almost seemed to have a death wish. And I was spending more time reading Shakespeare than John Henry Evans, more time with Eugene O'Neill than B.H. Roberts, more energy absorbing Samuel Beckett than the Book of Matthew. They were telling me truths I hadn't contemplated before. Then maybe 25 years ago, I started writing. I started with a Western just to see if I could do it, write anything. And I wrote this genre Western with a Mormon twist, and I called it The Avenging Angel. And it was a finalist in the Bantam Western Writing Contest, and it rested at the bottom of a dusty drawer for 15 years until this Hollywood friend of mine who liked my work called to say Ted Turner was looking for Westerns. Had I written any? And I almost said no. But it did get turned into this movie, and it got made in Utah, partly because they got Charlton Heston to play Brigham Young. And the movie wasn't all that bad for what it was. But I'd long ago tired of good guys and bad guys and shootouts and horses. And after that, I got fascinated by Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler and their visions of the dark sides of the societies they inhabited. And I wrote a trilogy of mysteries set in Salt Lake. St. Martin's Press even published a couple, The Tenth Virgin and the Sarah Hemla Vision. But I hadn't really much of a gift for narrative detail, and I tired of those too. And finally, I sat down one day and started a play, and it came pretty fast. And I directed it as part of the season for the professional summer theater I produce. And I also did a student production, and audiences seemed to really like it, even most of the Mormons. And I called it Daddy's Gone Home to Mother in Heaven. And it was produced other places, and it seemed genuinely funny in 1985. But when the Salt Lake Acting Company did a reading in 1995, it sounded forced and dated, and I didn't like it much anymore. And my second play, The Whitehead Family Reunion, about a clan of contrary Southern Utah polygamists, got significant attention. Actors Theater of Louisville did a reading. Berkeley Rep staged it. I directed some fine professional actors in a production. But I have mixed feelings now. Too derivative, too much in Sam Shepard's backdraft. And 15 years ago, I started reading the Bible again, reading it fresh with grown-up eyes. And I realized the greatest of the kings and prophets and apostles were these complex and often damaged characters, and damn interesting dramatically. And God was blessing them in all their strange and dark complexity. Then I went back to parts of the Book of Mormon and the Doctrine and Covenants and Joseph's amazing final sermons. And I began to discover the biblical power and scope there. And I was off on something I could claim more as my own. And the next play I wrote was called Downwinder Dance, and it's about the awful effects of the nuclear tests on the people of southwestern Utah, about a third of whom are my blood relatives. And the central character is this young man who's called by an angel to be a prophet and has to figure out just what that means he's supposed to do. And I'd begun to find a voice. And others responded too, and it played the Kennedy Center, and I directed a professional production with Hollywood actors, and it was published by Samuel French, and I still like that play. And in my next play, Mary and Joe, I go to Shakespeare and Beckett and the J-text of the Bible, and I mix them up with my own neurotic Mormon obsessions, and the play's kind of perplexing to audiences. But they seem to like it okay, and I like it more than anything I've ever written, and I feel I've almost arrived as a writer I can put up with. So then this last year, I decided to jump in and grapple with Joseph Smith himself. Not at first with a play in mind. I've been working on a series of monologues and performance pieces. I read one here last year about my mission in Great Britain. And I read and reread everything I could about Joseph Smith for half a year I did that. And after 3 or 4 months, I decided maybe I should try it as a play. And off I went, a plunge into serious rapids. I've got a few water metaphors through here, that some of which work and some of which don't, but I just left them. I figured early I couldn't put all of Joseph Smith into a single play, not yet, so I decided to focus on his early years, pretty much the New York Joseph Smith. One thing that came clear to me in my readings was that Joseph was, from the beginning, on a serious religious quest. He saw angels and he saw God, and it came clear he read the Bible in ways nobody else ever did. And he squeezed his own exalted mission out of the scriptures and out of the heavenly and human beings he encountered. Another thing that came clear to me was that Joseph had a sharp sense of humor, certainly a sense of fun, mischief, at least a keen sense of irony. And sure, he used magic stones to dig for treasure, and he did tend to mix up his search for God and his search for ancient treasure. And the Book of Mormon was a remarkable coming together of those impulses. And it came clear to me that he felt he transgressed in serious enough ways he felt compelled to ask God personally for forgiveness. Most of his guilt apparently having to do with his passions and with the company he kept and with what he described as his light and trifling mind. All right, I'd made a couple of decisions, so I forged ahead. The first thing I had to do was figure out how to organize the play. What plot would tie all this stuff together? I decided on the pretty obvious and, I thought, rather simple method of writing a series of scenes pairing Joseph with the essential people in his early life. Obvious ones: his mother, his father, Martin, Oliver, David, the angel, and, of course, Emma. And as I trolled through early documents, several not-so-obvious figures got me interested. Reverend Lane, Sally Chase, Obadiah Dogberry, Lumen Walters. And I finished a way too long and seriously overwritten draft in a rather short time. I cut more than two-thirds of it right after I first heard it out loud. At auditions, I found it fairly easy to cast the secondary characters. Each had a clear place in Joseph's life. Each had an agenda, a primary objective. But casting Joseph was another matter. At auditions, I didn't have anyone who was even close to being able to play Joseph. A character I call the actor explains it to the audience. The actor. For the most part, each character in the play will be played by one actor, except for Joseph Smith. In one scene or another, Joseph Smith will be played by all the men. The writer is insisting on this because he indicated he wants to capture as many aspects of Joseph Smith as possible. What he really means is that none of us appears to him to have the chops for the role. What about the women, we ask? He says he wants at least one woman as well as the men to play Joseph Smith. When pushed, the writer admits that the only actor he knows who could play Joseph Smith adequately is currently in an asylum for the criminally insane somewhere in Pennsylvania. So I had a second draft of the play, a cast of competent actors and plenty of rehearsal time. What I still didn't have was a plot, and I never even got close. What I finally ended up doing was adding material for several narrators, including the actor, each of whom embodies one of many points of view it's possible to have about Joseph Smith. Maybe my favorite is a 12-year-old girl who approaches Joseph from a rather naive perspective. Since I only cover Joseph's early life, I have her give a brief biography of the prophet in the form of a book report. The girl. Joseph Smith was born December 23, 1805, in Sharon, Windsor County, Vermont. His mother was Lucy Mack Smith, and his father was Joseph Smith Sr. The Smith family was very poor, and they moved around a lot, and the mother, Lucy Mack Smith, worked very hard to support them, as did the six sons and a daughter, and Joseph Sr. did too when he was able. Joseph Smith published the Book of Mormon in 1830. He translated it from Golden Plates an angel gave him. He started the church in 1830, and he moved his family and the church to Kirtland, Ohio in 1831, and had many revelations from God, which he had people write down. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints grew very fast and gathered all kinds of followers. And there were many miracles and visitations by heavenly beings. And Joseph Smith got interested in many things, including creating a bank, rewriting the Bible, and leading a military invasion of Missouri. After Joseph Smith did hard time in a Missouri prison, he escaped and led his followers to Nauvoo, Illinois, where they built a great city and became politically very powerful. Joseph Smith continued to receive many revelations from God, which told him, among other things, to be mayor of his city, to be general of his army, to build a temple for ancient ceremonies, to run for president, to crown himself king of God's earthly kingdom, to marry at least 10 virgins and lots of other women, and to begin immediate preparations to become a god. He was killed at the age of 38 by people who took exception to most of what God told him to do. There are now pretty statues of Joseph Smith all over Nauvoo and Salt Lake City, Utah, where the Mormons went after Joseph Smith was killed. There are currently over 11 million members of Joseph Smith Church, almost all of whom think he was the most important man who ever lived, with the exception, of course, of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Thank you. And there's this academic I call the psychologist. In order to fully account for Joseph Smith, one must apply the precise and methodological tools of science. My carefully researched clinical diagnostic conclusion is that Joseph Smith had an acute disease known as severe vainglorious personality disorder. And then he utters a mouthful of jargon, to which the girl adds, Joseph Smith has also been characterized by out-of-joint 20th century psychologists as a hallucinating epileptic, a delusional paranoid, a manic depressive wacko, a narcissistic fanatic, and as just a plain nutcase. Thank you. And there's the Christian evangelist. Joseph Smith was a classical humanist atheist. He rejected the one true God of the Bible and in his place proposed an infinite and never-increasing number of self-made gods who had each once been a man. Now, brothers and sisters, this is doctrine direct from the Antichrist. And unless you accept the true and evangelically sanctioned Jesus Christ into your hearts You'll be left in your shoes looking up in pain when the rapture comes. And I developed Joseph Smith's first newspaper critic into the character Dogberry. After Joseph's encounter with Reverend Lane, he says, "You never quite know when this Joe Smith's pulling your leg. And there's deeper mischief there, a kind of otherworld juggler struck by God mischief. Reverend Lane can't fathom. Hell, I can't figure it. The fellow's got things up his sleeve." And Dogberry's comments after a scene between Joseph and his father. There are a pair of those two, wily, dark, poking fun at things, slippery like water creatures, and they want your valuables. You see the old man coming, hold on to your watch. You see the sun, hold on to your faith. I'm particularly fond of Blossom, who offers enthusiastic and extravagant encomiums to Joseph Smith. I find that most people are quite limited in their assessment of Joseph Smith, reductionist. They're really working out their own inadequacies, their resentments. Yes, resentments, that captures it. Pretty much everyone who attempts to assess Joseph Smith really comes to resent him. He's too much for him. How could he dare such things? How could anybody dare such things? I think Joseph Smith was an authentic religious genius. A man of stature like Moses or Zoroaster or Muhammad or Jesus, an authentic American genius. I'd go so far as to place him alongside Emerson and Whitman as one of three seminal 19th century American geniuses. And there's Fielding, who was fiercely protective of the church's proprietary right to Joseph Smith and particularly annoyed at Blossom. "It's just nonsense, and it gets my blood boiling. People like you just don't have any right. Joseph Smith is our prophet. He belongs to us, to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, not to disgruntled psychologists or out-of-whack Christian evangelicals or Mormon intellectuals or literary critics turned religious dilettantes." But a potpourri of narrative risks do not a playmate, and I knew I had a problem when I found the narrators more interesting than the dramatic characters. But I went on anyway, focusing on the supporting characters. I kind of liked my Oliver, who's a bit overwhelmed by it all. And I tackled Martin Harris. And I wrote a confrontation with Reverend Lane. And I wrote Joseph apprenticing to a flashy Lumen Walters and a scene with Sally Chase, who had a white seer stone and who I imagined as a source for some of Joseph's guilt about his overworked passion. And I think I captured some aspects of Emma. Emma. Emma says, "My father doesn't care for Joseph, not at all. In fact, Joseph makes him very angry. All that boy does is poke around in the dirt trying to find some damn Indian treasure. I don't say much, I just nod. You never get far with arguing with my father. And that rock he carries around with him, what's he expect to find with a goddamn rock? I just smile, occasionally say something impertinent, which he doesn't care for. He calls me high-spirited, my father, and not in a complimentary way. And he knows I was interested in Joseph from the first. I guess you could say I was feeling things, despite what people think when they first regard me. I am a woman of some passion. Yes, I had my doubts. He didn't seem much of a prospect. He was unschooled, had appalling grammar, didn't keep himself clean. Just finishes one dream, he's on to the next. There were all sorts of warning signs. But when he talks, well, you just have to listen. You're part of whatever world he's sculpting with his words. And when he looks at you, dear God, that look, you're just transfixed by that look. And his face, it's never the same, that face. Another thought, another look, you couldn't paint that face." And I did make some headway toward my own dramatic understanding of Joseph Smith in some of the scenes I wrote. I got particularly interested in Joseph's relationship with his father. I never thought much about Joseph Smith Sr., but I found myself looking everywhere for clues to his characters, getting more fascinated with each new discovery. Who was this shadowy figure moving with Joseph through his life? How did he affect his son, influence him? It's seldom somebody's more important than your father in shaping a son's life. It's a hunt I'm still on. And the three scenes I wrote with Joseph and his father have a ring of truth, at least to me. I think Joseph and his father were very close. In the first scene with his father, Joseph comes upon Joseph Sr. in the woods. After some banter, he tells his father what he was up to the night before. I got us a sheep. You did? I'm over at Will Stafford's place, and I put my stone in my hat. Will, I'm seeing treasure. And this treasure's not 500 yards from your front door. And he gets this look in his eye like he sees I'm seeing things. A treasure? And we'll get this treasure this very night. We will. God is my witness. Son of a gun, Joe. Now what we need, Will, is one of your black sheep. And you don't quite get it. Black sheep? It's part of the holy ritual, Will. And what does that do, Joe? What that does is prime the treasure so it's ready to pop out of the ground. Well, damn. So Will gets me his prime black sheep, and we cut his throat, and while it's still struggling, we make us a blood circle, and I plant a hazel stick in the center, and I put the shovel in his hands, and I say, you know, you got a big night ahead of you here, Will. Better start digging. And when he gets all cut up digging, I take that sheep and slip into the woods, and right now Ma's dressing it for dinner. Now, this might not be a way Joseph's light and trifling mind worked, or a good example of his dubious friends, it's being his own father. And early in the first scene with his father, Joseph does bring up serious issues. He asks him, you think there's this fire and brimstone God's got ready for us, this anguish and pain and burning hell forever and ever? To which his father replies, the burning hell that counts is right here. God knows that's awful enough. Dark. Joseph pauses, then says, I have yearnings, you know. Of course you do. We all have yearnings. Real strong sometimes. God put us here to be happy, to have joy. That's part of having joy. Now your mother's always had a burning. I find I don't mind that much. And then Joseph Sr. has something for his son. Father says, I had another one. What his father had was another dream. While trying to figure the young Joseph out, I found myself going repeatedly back to Joseph Sr.'s dreams. I can't help but think they were enormously influential in creating the central images through which Joseph understood and created his world. Whatever you think about how the Book of Mormon came about, the parallels between Lehi's great dream and one of Joseph Sr.'s dreams is remarkable. And something else about those dreams struck me. In the scene, the father tells Joseph of a new dream that's not unlike his earlier dreams or visions. The father, I'm traveling on this on and on in this barren and desolate field, and I'm sore and lame and heavy of heart. And I tell the spirit's there with me again. Hold on, spirit, I just got to sit down and rest. No, you got to keep going. So I keep walking, and there's this rope I'm supposed to hang on to and find the way. And then I'm in the middle of this garden, and there's this wondrous building, and there's a man at the door, and I ask if I can go in, and he says I can. And inside this big, luxurious room, and in the middle of this room is this altar, and on top of the altar is this box, this beautiful chest. And I approach it, and this miraculous feeling comes over me, and I reach to open it, and I touch the lid, and I wake up. And Joseph is moved. He's so moved that after a long silence between the two characters, he has to change the subject. I told Reverend Lane about the toad. The father's amused. Do you believe the toad? You don't seem real comfortable with magic toads. Father, he thinks we're these crazy conjurers. Then I told him maybe it was the angel. That must have stumped him. He told me I was an evil boy and I saw so many versions of the truth, God's going to damn me. There's another long silence, and Joseph gets back to the dream. Joseph, I dream your dreams. Father, I know you do. I won't give up till I taste what's inside that box you dream about. Father, I did taste it once, what was inside. Was it sweet? Sweetest thing I ever tasted. Joseph, I have to taste it. Father adds after a long pause. And the awfulest thing I ever tasted. And I was filled with terror and I woke up in cold sweats. But Joseph keeps looking for that box, and a bit later he asks the angel if the box buried in the hill is his father's box. And the angel says, I think it's more your box. Toward the end of the first scene between Joseph and Emma, I have Joseph bring up something I find extremely interesting, something he seemed to be obsessed with from his earliest writings, and is perhaps the closest thing I could find to what Joseph's character's super objective might be, his intention, his motive, his life's mission, the constant that kept him pushing ahead against incomprehensibly impossible odds. He tells Emma, When I'm right with God, with people I love, I see the most amazing things. It's like I'm carried past this veil into a world nobody else sees, and it's a marvelous world, endless in its space. It just goes on, and I can wander through lush meadows and vibrant gardens, past immense mysterious trees and into great shining cities. And lately I've been seeing people, people from the beginning of time, people from the end of time, people yearning from all time, and they want to speak to me. They want me to do something for them. The brother of Jared saw these multitudes, Lehi saw these multitudes, Joseph Sr. saw multitudes, and Joseph Jr. saw multitudes. And he had to do something about it. He had to try and tie all these multitudes together in a great universal vision of salvation. But that's for the great play somebody else will write. 2 months ago, I drove to Ohio to spend a weekend with my good friend Don Nigro. Don Nigro was the most important unknown playwright in the United States. And there are Nigro cults all around the world. One clue to his importance is that if you look in the Samuel French play catalog, Don Nigro has more plays currently in print than any other playwright, living or dead. There are people who think he's a genius. He's certainly the smartest person I've ever met and one of the best writers. Don and I wrote a draft of a Joseph Smith play 20 years ago. I wanted to call it God is My Right-Hand Man. Most of you know the reference. Don said that sounded too much like a bad World War II movie, like Dane Clark and Dennis Morgan in God is My Co-Pilot. We never got around to titling it. We didn't get past the first draft. But during this recent visit, Don and I talked about the play, and near the end of our talk, he told me he agreed I really didn't have a Joseph Smith play, but he said what I maybe did have was a play about his mother, a Lucy Mack Smith play. I don't know, I somehow doubt it. But I will finish here with a Lucy Mack Smith monologue from the Joseph Smith Project, which includes a version of her dream, her amazing dream. I play some with the original, but include much of her wonderful language. The first thing you have to know about all this is it's a family matter. It's not about one special emissary being visited by an angel and all by himself bringing the true gospel to a chaotic and unenlightened world. No, this is a visionary family. My father saw lights bright as a fire in a dark night, and in those lights he saw Jesus Christ. And there's my dream, where I was carried off to a magnificent meadow to this tree that shone like burnished gold and stood beside a pure, clear stream of water. And the tree bent gracefully before the wind, and its branches waved over the stream with happiness and joy, lively as the dancing of a sunbeam. And I saw the tree was my husband. And he was pliant and flexible and ready to swell gently and recede with the breath of heaven. And it was right after that he began having visions, my husband. 7 God-inspired dreams that led him to the edge of salvation. But the search just went on. And he closed himself up more and more, and I had to conclude he wasn't worthy. So it fell to one of my sons, my fine big son. You figure, of course, the mantle's going to fall to the oldest, Alvin, who was building his mother a nice house. But the Lord saw fit to carry Alvin away. Then there was Hiram, good, gentle Hiram. But Hiram wasn't really up to it. So I accepted it had to be Joseph. Now, I love all my sons, but Joseph just isn't quite, I don't know, not sober like Alvin or Hiram, always chasing this fancy or that, off telling stories when there's work to be done, making no account people laugh, digging about in the dirt, getting whiskey for his father. Oh, I enjoy Joseph. I love his stories. He's real entertaining, Joseph. But the family prophet? In the end, she accepts Joseph and writes lucidly about him, and I write what I see as her discovery in the play. I have to say he did make me believe, Joseph. It's like he pulled me to my feet and shouted at me to believe. Ma, I saw this angel, and this angel led me to these golden plates. Golden plates. Well, this was something his father couldn't have done. Heavy, real, bright as a sunbeam, gold plates. When he told me about the gold plates, I knew he was my son. As I said earlier, one of the things that stopped me cold on this play is the confusion between Joseph Smith, the dramatic character, and all the personal baggage I bring out of my 60-year dialogue with Joseph. And I do worry about my qualifications. I think most everybody who's written about Joseph Smith has somehow or other reduced him. whether they make him into this pretty flawless godlike character, or whether they make him this conscious or unconscious charlatan, or equate him with 20th century church leaders, or whether they try to put him in some conceptual box. I even think my own neurotic take on Joseph also includes my take on my own mother. I frankly don't know for sure where Joseph's mother ends and my mother begins. And that leads me to the real reason I've had to put the play away, like my father put sick animals down. I frankly really enjoy being unsure about Joseph Smith. I don't want to understand his motives, the reasons he did things, not really. I like the mystery. I like changing my mind about him every few months. I like hearing his voice layered with levels of wit and irony I can't prove and can't adequately write. I want to keep pondering Harold Bloom's strange characterization of Joseph as a robust American humorist. And I just like too much the constant surprise every time I read something he wrote or ponder something he did. And I like to keep pondering the weird and the shadowy sides of Joseph. Ponder them without giving them form. He's just too interesting to me in his inky mystery. That's my last water metaphor. A pertinent analogy. I've come to dislike with some passion those critics who attempt to describe Hamlet's dramatic action, to define his major motive, to nail his objective. It's just too reductive. Thumbs down this wondrous and mysterious and enigmatic play. And like Hamlet, Joseph was a player, challenged others to see him in different roles. What about all those ways he insisted people see him? What about all those roles he played, all those masks? Look at all those masks. Look at that horrifying and compelling final mask, his death mask. What a remarkable character, remarkable in all his complexity and luminosity and holiness and contrariety and strangeness. What an amazing thing somebody may do sometime, capture all this in a brilliant theatrical conceit. It can ever only exist for me in some constantly permutating theater of my mind. Oh, yeah, we're sharing this mini mic.
Thank you, Gary. We'll now hear from Tim. What little I know about Tim is that he is a prize-winning playwright. I did see his play about Handel at Pioneer last season. And I also saw the version of Utah that he did down at Tucson a few years ago. So we'll hear from Tim now. And if there's time, then we'll have questions.
I'm sure there'll be time. I mean, that's the whole point. So I'm going to keep this brief. As Gary can, and we've never met. Pleasure to meet you. But as Gary can tell you, all playwrights are award-winning. I want to just take maybe five or six minutes so that you can get to comments and questions. Is this? Do I have to keep my head down? Okay. I'll just go like this. As Gary knows, and as most of you know, there's a history of trying to present in dramatic form Joseph Smith, mostly done by Mormons, who are the people that are really interested in Joseph Smith. And that's part of the problem always in this kind of endeavor. The attempt often, not what Gary has done, but the attempt often is to try to present a hero, maybe a flawed hero. And Peter Brook, the great theater practitioner and philosopher, and guru, reminds us how hard it is to dramatize a hero. He says the hero is, quote, that figure that for our theater is always the most elusive one of all. He adds, I had long doubted that heroes could be depicted. In our terms, the heroes, like all good characters, easily become pallid and sentimental or wooden and ridiculous, and it's only as we go toward villainy that something interesting can begin to appear. So one of the people that tried this that wasn't a Mormon, interestingly enough, was Robert Bolt, the writer of A Man for All Seasons and Lawrence of Arabia, who wanted to do a filmic treatment of Joseph Smith and wanted to present him as a flawed hero, like his Lawrence and like his V.I. Lenin, another of his plays. That was an attempt. That was never made, interestingly enough. He also abandoned the project. The screenwriter and director and Mormon, Peter Johnson, has created an excellent film narrative. In that one, Joseph Smith is sort of the suffering servant, the persecuted saint. James Arrington, who many of you know, tried for a Joseph in a play of his that was so elusive, it reminded me of when Gary was talking about casting different actors to play the role, that this Joseph was actually a different person completely, with different personality traits as he interacted with other characters. Finally, as many of you know, the filmmaker Richard Dutcher is planning a new film about Joseph Smith, and Crawford Gates, the composer, has composed a new opera, both with Joseph as the central figure. So it's almost a subgenre, the Joseph Smith play. Gary's approach, based on what we've heard today, seems to me different from all of these. He acknowledges the usefulness of a plot line in conventional realistic drama, but is clearly more interested in a study of Joseph's character. Reminds me a little bit of T.S. Eliot's Murder in the Cathedral, or a recent play that was in New York called Dirty Blonde. The subject of the first is Thomas Becket, the saint. The subject of the second is Mae West, a saint to some. And they're both presented through a collage of their own and other people's statements. For instance, various real and allegorical characters come to visit Thomas Becket on the night of his martyrdom. Mae West's contemporary admirers look back on her life and try to emulate her, both male and female. It ends with an interesting cross-dressing scene. Susan Howe's play about Joseph Smith, Burdens of Earth, seems to take this approach, the same one to Joseph Smith. In this play, Joseph, while imprisoned in Liberty Jail, is gnawed by doubt about his actions, given how much others have suffered as a result of them. Characters visit his mind, and hence the stage, as he works through whether he has acted well. In the end, he decides he has. But of all the Joseph Smith depictions of which I'm aware, the fragments of dialogue that I got to read and that we just got to hear from Gary's play seem to me to be the best in terms of their humanness and a sort of essential truth to them. Especially that dialogue between Joseph Smith Sr. and Joseph Smith Jr., which reminds me of an early play that was done, again, not produced, but a play called Digger, that really tries to get at the kind of human qualities of Joseph Smith. I love that dialogue. So, as Gary muses, who's interested in such a character? What audience is suited to a play about Joseph Smith? For, as, again, Peter Brook reminds us, quote, the audience is the most vital and least considered element of the theater process. So, here are three different approaches that occurred to me and their respective audiences, which someone writing about Joseph Smith might consider as he or she works on a piece of performance writing about him. The first, a passionate play for a passionate audience, celebrating a central myth of its passion. This is what the medieval mystery plays were, and their power today is still extraordinary. In the African Mysteries, which were brought to London this spring from Cape Town, they were performed with great energy and vitality, with music done on kind of found instruments and dance elements and multicultural humor and done in four different languages. At any given time, someone might speak Xhosa or Afrikaans or Zulu or English. The profound depth of the performance of this passionate play for a passionate audience was not psychological at all, but ecstatic. All were drawn into this performance because of its remarkable commitment to the central myth of the incarnation. So, how about a Joseph Smith story with a similar passion and commitment to the central myth, identified so beautifully by Gary as Joseph's deep desire to, quote, tie all these multitudes together in a great universal vision of salvation? That's one approach, it seems to me, with one audience. Second, a materialist play for a materialist audience. I think Gary's putative off-Broadway audience. Such audiences generally like to see the fantastic claims of religious charlatans debunked or explained away by usually sexual psychology. Such plays function as a cautionary tale, not to be duped by irrational impulses. Julie Jensen's Two-Headed does this about polygamy, and has found great success and a great audience. Oddly enough, within the context of fundamental evangelism, The Godmakers also does this, warning against tolerating demonic anti-Christianity in the guise of mainstream religion. Second way. Third way, maybe, and what Tony Blair would call the third way. A play that focuses in on universal subject matter or a topical issue for what we might call the general audience. Those who are mostly looking, though unconsciously, for something which corresponds to their directly accessible dreams, desires, and concerns. Such a play is Shadowlands, in which C.S. Lewis's heartfelt and you know, half a lifelong commitment to Christian apologetics is backgrounded against a foreground of a love story. He does know this, but there has in fact been a Joseph and Emma love story. It was a musical written several years ago. And it wasn't particularly successful. But I think, and this is my conclusion, that though I haven't met Gary Stewart, he may be exactly the right person to write the Joseph Smith play.
Okay, we have one microphone here. And there's nothing worse than going and purchasing a tape of a session and finding that you cannot hear the questions. So if anybody has a question, I must ask you to come up, speak it into the microphone, and address it to either Gary or Tim, and they can respond.
There's a problem historically depicting Jesus theatrically. There was actually a period in American history where it was illegal to portray Jesus on stage. In film, you tend to get either, on the one hand, very glorified presentations like in Ben-Hur, where Jesus is this shadowy figure whose face you never see and never speaks, or on the other hand, you get this presentations that tend to be very offensive, like Jesus Christ Superstar or The Last Temptation of Christ or Corpus Christi. I'm wondering if perhaps Joseph Smith may just be, for Mormon audiences at least, a similarly polarized figure who simply cannot be represented satisfactorily in theater because of the significance that he has.
To me, when Joseph Smith says, whether you read him in the readings, that, you know, the key to the whole thing is that enthroned in yonder heavens is a man, and I seen him. To me, to try to do the Joseph Smith story, we have within Mormon culture the what I call the fluorescent approach to showing deity in the temple, which just, you know, all I can say is those of you who've seen that movie, that is what it is. I think that's a problem, too. So, yes, maybe it's Joseph Smith that's the icon we can't show the real face of, but can you even do Joseph Smith without somehow graphically showing God as a man? I think of him as a sandy-haired New Englander in a plaid shirt. That would do to show people God that way, I think. Sitting down, feet on the floor, that kind of God.
Well, everybody else is standing up. I'll do that. Well, I originally got interested in dramatizing Joseph Smith by reading the compilation, The Essential Joseph Smith, in the play that was published, or the book was published about 3 or 4 years ago, that included mainly his final sermons. And I read those and I thought, wow, you put all these together, what an extraordinary view of man. But not only that, what an extraordinary performer he must have been. And then I read some of the descriptions of how he moved back and forth on the platform and personalized things. And I tried some of that in the play, how he would tell stories and play different roles for himself. And then I got stuck in this New York thing and never got out. And I think I never will get out. Thank you. I think I will drive myself crazy. I'm going to write about my wife next, who was an extraordinary woman with whom I lived almost 40 years. That seems more manageable. But I do think Joseph Smith is extraordinarily difficult because it's very hard to pin an objective down. Fawn Brody, I mean, has anybody really ultimately challenged No Man Knows My History in terms of story, sheer storytelling? She has a point of view, and I don't agree with that point of view, because I do think he was on a serious religious journey from the beginning. This whole thing about his sense of humor and sense of levels of meaning will always intrigue me. I haven't written Harold Bloom yet, but those words, a robust American humorist, just absolutely intrigue me. And I go back and I read, and where does he get humorist out of all of this? I may read it and, through an ironic perspective, find it humorous, but then I think the best example of that I found, and I probably ought to try to dramatize that, was Josiah Quincy's visit to Nauvoo when Joseph Smith put on a dog and pony show. Showed him the mummies, had his mother sitting there rocking back and forth, and said before they left us, "Gentlemen, it's customary that everyone who sees the display give my mother a quarter of a dollar." And she's sitting there performing her role beautifully in her rocking chair. Then Joseph goes outside the mansion house, and one of his compatriots, and he could never eat alone. He could never be alone, apparently, and I find this fascinating about him. But one of his compatriots says, "Oh, you've got to watch Joseph preach." So he drags Josiah Quincy around, and they all stand around the porch, and Joseph gets up and does 15 great minutes. And then they go take the carriage ride around, and there's the famous thing where Josiah Quincy said, "Don't you ever worry about having so much power as one man?" And Joseph looks at him and says, "Well, perhaps I would, but you see, I'm a prophet. And there are these extraordinary levels in that, where he's poking fun at himself, where he's saying seriously what he believes, maybe what his people believe about him that may or may not be true." I find that absolutely fascinating. And I just wish I had the skill. And I think maybe the character that Shakespeare wrote that we ought to get part of the quality into Joseph Smith could perhaps be Falstaff, not only because Joseph got portly in his later years, but because maybe he was attempting to teach us things through similar kinds of humorous approaches. I don't know. That's my problem. I don't know.
No one has yet said anything that discourages me about this play. I have long felt that if you get a very complex character, Brigham Young comes to mind because of perhaps what Mark Twain wrote about him in Roughing It, that perhaps the truth of a complex character is the sum total of what everybody thinks about him. And it seems to me, Gary, you have exactly the right approach to this very complex, fascinating, inexplicable conundrum, Joseph Smith. And so I guess my question is, what I heard sounded very good, and maybe you want to tinker with the whole in ways, but why ultimately isn't this a grand approach to presenting? Why isn't there just in the goal of presenting the enigma of the man the seeds of success?
Part of the answer to that, from my point of view, is that not very many people were very interested in what I was doing. That interested me. I went into a class of students, of theater students, intro to theater students who were not majors, to talk about it, and they'd all seen it, and they just sat there. And finally I said, "How many of you have heard of Joseph Smith?" Four hands went up out of a class of 65. And then finally I said, "How many of you are interested in religion?" Maybe seven hands went up. I don't know. I read you my best shots. I will confess that. And thank you. But I think what little time I have left will be better served doing other things. I will keep this for my granddaughters and anybody who might be interested. But you've got to have an audience, and you have to have. I see what you mean by the, yeah, and the sort of fragmented, almost postmodern approach to them is the only way I could do it, even halfway. And probably if I were if I had an audience that were really compelled, was really compelled by that, I'd do it. But I don't have. I've been kind of contrary. I mean, not many people know me, and yet I've written a lot, and I've just never had anything done in Utah. And this is my second presentation at Sunstone. I've come quite a lot off and on through the years, and but I've tried to find an audience out there of people who aren't necessarily Mormon, which would allow me to work out my neurotic Mormon obsessions, and I've been pretty successful at it. But this just stopped me cold, and I have to go other places.
Gary, you have an international audience. All of this interest over polygamy, the theme of love, the intrigue over Joseph Smith and how he struggled over the issue of polygamy, and then Emma, so violently opposed, and also these young maidens whom, oh, wow. This would be international. You have the ability, you have the interest right now. I might get excommunicated for suggesting it to you, but wow, what passion, what possibilities, what daring.
Well, so far the church hasn't really been interested enough in me to excommunicate me, so... They have put me on some lists. I know that, but I think that's right. I mean it's just maybe you want to write it. I like that. Okay, well let's talk. Let's talk after. One scene I thought was pretty good was a scene with Sally Chase, who has the stone and a serious interest in the occult and other things that Joseph, I think, was undoubtedly interested in when he was very young, which was women. I do think that didn't just come out of nowhere. I think that there were some Sally Chases or whatever. I don't know that it was Sally Chase, but there was a Sally Chase who had a white seer stone. I know that, and that just sort of popped into my head. But, it seems like it ought to really work, doesn't it?
Maybe you can have a fictitious character and just base it on Joseph Smith. That might work better. If y'all haven't seen The Avenging Angel, the movie, it's really fun. We've rented it several times at Blockbuster, and it's just great. If you just want to be real happy and learn something about Utah history and see a real good Western, it's really good. And I also, I don't know how I fell into these things, but I have a copy of the Zarahemla Vision. And, oh, it's fun. He's a great writer, and I came today when I saw that he was on the program because I wanted to see this crazy guy.
A kind of technical question. It's very obvious to me why you're preoccupied with characterization. Perhaps impossible task of characterization, why any writer has to be. What I would like to know is, as a director and playwright, somebody who's really also preoccupied, and obviously from what you said, preoccupied with the issue of plot, why was it so difficult for you to get on to looking into and to reporting on that matter?
The Hamlet analogy kept coming at me. I've spent the time I haven't spent reading Joseph Smith in the last year, I have spent reading Hamlet, because the two are entangled in my mind. Because I read a book when I was a young man in grad school that a peer of mine asked me to read. It's called The Heart of Hamlet by Grevenier, and what Grevenier does is say Hamlet doesn't hesitate. And he goes through the play and he argues at every point that Hamlet acts as fast as he could. And that ultimately this is not a play about hesitation, that it's a play, and I believed that, and I loved it for 25 years, and then I thought, I'm going to direct Hamlet, and I sat down and I read the play, and I thought, well, that's just nuts. I mean, we're talking 2-3 months here going by, and then I read it again, and I thought, well, but I really love this play. And what I really love about this play is that there are so many Hamlets. And ultimately, what I really love about Joseph Smith is that there are so many Joseph Smiths. And I'm fascinated by a lot of them. Some of them bore me. Some of them, I think, set up things in the contemporary world and church that I don't like very much. I think that there are aspects of him that I don't care for. His kind of increasing obsession with authoritarianism and with having himself crowned king. But that's only part of it. And I'm never quite sure why he did anything. And if I write this play, I got to decide that. You can't write a dramatic character, you can't write a play unless you make a decision about why this person does that thing. And I don't know. And I don't think I'll ever know. And ultimately, I don't really want to know.
Okay, our time is up. I want to thank all of you for coming, and thank Gary and Tim for their comments, and all of you for your comments. Thank you.